From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block, joined now by someone who's going to urge you to grow your own drugs. Now, we're not talking about the illicit kind. We're talking about a living pharmacy of plants from your own backyard. Fennel and rose hips, echinacea and dandelion, horse chestnuts and nettles. James Wong is an ethnobotanist. He trained at the Royal Botanic Gardens in London, and he's written a medicinal recipe book called Grow Your Own Drugs. It's an offshoot of his BBC television series. James, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you say at the outset, James, you are not against conventional medicine, but you look all around you at plants and you see these little, bright, beautiful chemical factories.
That's a really good way of putting it, actually. I think so many people have this stereotyped idea of what herbal medicine is. And it's, I think they've almost got a big black line in their minds that separates serious, conventional, tested scientific medicine on one side and slightly airy-fairy, away with the hippies, you know, natural but probably doesn't work, plant-based medicine on another. And I think it's really important as a scientist to show that this sort of big black line that so many people have in their minds is really a cultural idea, not a scientific one. You know, to me as a scientist, whether a chemical is found within a pill or the cells of a plant is really irrelevant. I mean, that's just packaging. It's whether, you know, there's a plausibility that it works or not. So I'm totally not against conventional medicine. I mean, I'm the person who's popping aspirin whenever I've got the opportunity. But, you know, if I'm at home and I've got things to hand, I might well make an extract using willow bark, for example, an extract using meadowsweet, which are the plants that aspirin was first derived from, and in many senses can be seen as in some ways superior and in some ways practical, depending on your situation.
You have recipes in this book for remedies for just a wide range of ailments, everything from hot flashes to eczema to arthritis. And I want to talk about your treatment for something that has driven so many parents and children to complete distraction, head lice.
Conventional medicine or conventional treatments for head lice, in the UK at least, are proving increasingly problematic in treating head lice because head lice are becoming immune to the chemicals that are traditionally used. So there is a big interest in looking at alternatives. And one of these is neem oil that we use. Neem oil works in an entirely different way as an insecticide. It actually mimics the chemicals, hormones that an insect has in its body. And it basically sends off the wrong chemical messages to the insect. So it produces lots of problems with it feeding, it reproducing, and it molting. But it's entirely safe for all mammals, just toxic to insects.
What is neem oil?
Neem oil is an oil that's produced from a tree, a subtropical tree native to India, and it's quite widely available in health food shops, and it's not particularly expensive either.
I can imagine skeptical parents everywhere right now listening to this and wondering, does it really work?
Well, I would say to that, give it a go. As with all herbal remedies, they don't necessarily come with guarantees. And if you've tried conventional stuff and it hasn't, I don't think there's any harm in giving it a go.
And you have the neem oil in your recipe mixed up with almond oil, garlic cloves, tea tree oil, rosemary, lavender, I guess, just to smell pretty.
Actually, all of those ingredients have been used traditionally for their insecticidal properties. It's the essential oils within them that's the key insecticidal compound. I think in human terms, when you think of how long we've been battling with insects, you're talking a couple of thousand years. When you think about how long plants have been waging sort of warfare with insects, this goes back millions of years. And over that huge period, there's been time for them to evolve all sorts of unusual strategies, many of which are natural chemical weapons, insecticides that exist in the environment that can be used in all manner of ways. It's really many of the recipes that I've used are basically about hijacking chemicals that plants have evolved for themselves and using them to treat people and animals.
You have a recipe in here for treating athlete's foot with a garlic foot bath, a lot of garlic, some sage leaves, cider vinegar, and that you say will cure what ails you if you've got athlete's foot.
Well, all of those ingredients have antifungal properties, particularly garlic, and in particular the concentration that we're using them at. Plenty of garlic, plenty of sage, plenty of lavender, and one of my key things that I wanted to get across in this book and series is that natural medicine doesn't have to be about trekking off to the Amazon. It's about plants that are growing in and around your neighbourhood that are accessible to you. And, you know, when you're thinking about lavender and sage, so many people have got them in their back garden anyway. And things like garlic and sage are probably in your spice rack. It's about things that are easy and accessible, and you don't need any more equipment than, you know, I used to have in my student kitchen when I knocked them up at university.
Now, a few caveats we should toss in here. You say if you're sick, you should, of course, talk to your doctor. Do not self-diagnose.
Very much so. I'm an ethnobotanist by training, which is a scientist that studies the use of plants. I'm not medically trained. There are all sorts of interesting solutions that are found in the plant world, but, you know, you need to be responsible. You need to make sure that you have a proper diagnosis and know exactly what you've got. And, you know, once you've got that, you can consider using plant-based remedies as part of the solution. But it's very much not about abandoning conventional medicine. It's almost like a useful complement to it.
And also, you say, know what you're picking. Be very careful of poisonous plants, of course.
That's a very important thing. I think, you know, as a botanist, it's quite easy to forget that to the layman, you know, there are lots of poisonous plants that are morphologically in their shape very, very similar to perfectly useful plants. And it really is important to get a good guidebook and, you know, visually identify exactly what you're looking for.
James, do you have an all-time favorite medicinal plant?
Oh, gosh, it really is like picking between your children. You might have one, but you wouldn't like to say it to make the other ones feel bad. What would I say? I'd say probably garlic. It's my favourite, although it's not particularly exotic and far-flung and unusual. But it's my favourite probably because of all those things. It's so widely available. You can get it in whichever country in the world you're at. It's so easy to grow. It tastes brilliant. But it has such a huge range of medicinal uses. It's antifungal, it's antibacterial, and it's antiviral. So really, with all of those uses combined, it's just such a one-stop shop. You just have to pick it.
James Wong is the author of Grow Your Own Drugs. James, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
And at npr.org, you can find his recipes for treatments for head lice and athlete's foot, along with a recipe to add some fizzy fun to your bath. Now to another vision for Detroit. For $1, you can own a piece of the Motor City. It'll be a small piece, 1 square inch to be exact, but your investment in that micro plot of land also gives you passage into an online community that's coming up with bigger ideas for the city. Sarah Hewlett of Michigan Radio explains.
Jerry Pfaffendorf is not your typical real estate developer, but then the people lining up to buy into his project are not quite your typical investors.
Inchvestors, first off, we call them Inchvestors.
Pfaffendorf calls his project Loveland, and it's a hybrid, part virtual and part physical.
It's almost like what we want to do is we want to build this wild, you know, social network of people that's like literally built out of the dirt and like the ground.
This is the physical part, a vacant lot with a view of a burned out garage and several other empty parcels.
We are at the intersection of Verner Highway and Holcomb Street on the east side of Detroit. And we are walking over to the first property that I purchased for the Loveland project.
Pfaffendorf bought this property at auction for $500. Then he put 10,000 square inches up for sale, and people from all over the planet began snapping them up. They've now all been sold to nearly 600 people. The deeds Pfaffendorf mails out are not legally valid, so the people who buy inches won't get to vote in Detroit or have to pay taxes. Some Inchvestors have sentimental ties to the city and just like the idea of having a physical stake in the place where they or their parents or grandparents grew up. But a lot of them are attracted by the project's virtual possibilities and say Loveland is sort of like the popular SimCity or Farmville online games, but with real land. Rita King is the biggest landholder in Loveland with 1,000 inches. She works for IBM, and she's an entrepreneur with a firm that helps companies use social media and virtual worlds. King is excited about the project's potential to help the real city in which Loveland sits.
because Loveland is physically located in Detroit, it takes those 500 investors and it ties us to Detroit, which means that the development of Detroit is now of critical importance to hundreds of people who don't live or work in Detroit. And now I, for one, am starting to look very, very closely at Detroit and how can I help Detroit level up along with Loveland in our small way.
Leveling up is a phrase from the world of video games. It's what happens when the character you're playing makes it to the next level in the game. And for many, it's an apt description of what Detroit needs to do. King says she expects the online component of Loveland to include interactive maps and stories. And proceeds from the project's next phase are expected to be used to fund grants for nonprofit groups around Detroit. But for all the excitement about the possibilities Loveland holds with high-minded techno-futurists, the project is also fodder for derision and mockery in some quarters. On an online discussion board called Detroit Yes, one commentator said it sounded like a pyramid scheme without the pyramid. Bill Johnson is one of those who's criticized the project. Sitting at a coffee house in front of his laptop, he says it smacks of exploitation.
You know, in places outside of Detroit, we got a bad reputation as a sort of pitiful, worthless place. And this guy's preying on that. That's what he's really peddling.
But Loveland creator Jerry Papendorf says Detroit is a place of opportunity and creativity. And he shares an optimism about the city and his project with Ricky Collins. Collins is 9 years old and lives next door to the empty lot that Papendorf bought. She lives in the only house left on this block.
I want people to, like, remember this place. Remember it. And I want people to come over so we can get to know each other, learn the things about each other.
It's not clear how many of the people who've bought inches in Loveland will actually visit their tiny plots in person. But Rita King says she intends to make the trek from New York City. She also plans to install a mailbox so people can send things to and from the site. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Hewlett in Detroit.
As any moviegoer knows, movies make magic. A spaceship lands. Humans become avatars. A man in a cape flies. This Sunday, some of today's magicians will get Academy Awards. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg concludes her annual series, Hollywood Jobs, with a few creators of special effects.
Megabuck millions or ultra-low budget, the goal is the same. Frighten, fool, or thrill your audience. Various special effects companies spent years making the magic for Avatar. At Legacy Effects in the San Fernando Valley, about 120 people helped create the look of an imaginary moon and its population. But in a cramped trailer in Van Nuys, only two guys are mixing up fake blood for a slasher scene.
You sneak through here.
The film is called Class. Stands for Criminal Law and Student Slayings. It is so low budget, $1 million. They're shooting in producer Sheldon Robbins' aunt's house. Robbins puts much of his money on special effects makeup.
The most important part was making sure my kills didn't look cheesy.
Jerry Constantine will commit the makeup murders. He worked on the heavy-duty makeup film Benjamin Button. Usually, for bloody scenes, Jerry attaches plastic tubing to the actor's back and, with a syringe, fires fake blood through the tubing onto the screen. But not on this budget.
They don't have time for the two-hour makeup for me to pull the actor, glue the appliance on, and then squirt the blood, and so we fake it out.
Viewers will see the actor after the throat's been slit. Sorry, I know, breakfast time, but it's all make-believe, remember. Here's how it's done.
We're going to actually use this one because we're going to cut the heck out of it.
Jerry Constantine is snipping a super thin piece of latex foam, trimming it to glue onto the actor's throat. Mike Miesemer is Jerry's assistant.
This piece is going to wrap all the way around.
Yeah, this is going to work out perfect, Jerry.
Of course.
There's a horizontal slit in the foam piece. Jerry and Mike hold the fake skin against the actor's throat. The men work in tandem. Surgeons in reverse.
This is the clavicle?
Yeah.
Jerry powders the line where the foam meets skin. With a sponge dipped in makeup, he dabs various pinks onto the fake flesh, then sprays on some freckles.
in your head like that. Yeah.
That's just incredible. I would swear that was her skin.
Okay, are we about ready, Mike? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Just tilt your head back a bit.
And now, the slashing. Before it gets too terrible, we are going to cut away, as it were, to some of the special effects folks who worked on Avatar. But we'll be back.
There's some pieces from Terminator Salvation, and this big guy over here is the Iron Monger from Iron Man.
John Rosengrant worked for the late special effects pioneer Stan Winston, Jurassic Park, Aliens, for 25 years. The craft goes on at Rosengrant's company, Legacy Effects, where a big workroom is lined with specialty props from major action thrillers. Some outfits look like Transformers on steroids, pieces created by dozens and dozens of artisans.
Sculptors, mold makers, painters, seamstress, wig makers. It takes a huge group of people to make this stuff live.
Movie magic.
People are amazed when they look at Iron Man. It looks like it's hard, shiny metal, but then if you touch the actual suit in places, it's actually rubber.
Their challenge was to make the heavy armor light.
I don't understand why that was so hard. Centuries ago, knights wore shining armor and went to war. So if they could do it, why is such a problem now?
Well, actors don't want to be wearing a 100-pound suit of armor, sweating. Maybe they're cut out of a different cloth than those knights of yore.
In Avatar, the bad guy climbs into what looks like a tank with legs.
That's the AMP suit, which is short for Armored Mobile Platform. Yeah. It's like an Apache helicopter meets the power loader from Aliens.
13 feet high and really menacing. On a more human scale, John Rosengrant and his team also created the prosthetic legs actor Sam Worthington wears before his character Jake leaves his wheelchair to become an avatar. They found a Sam-sized young man whose paralysis didn't stop him from playing basketball and made a cast of his legs.
Finished them off in silicone and punched individual hairs into them, and those would get strapped onto Sam, and his legs would go down through the wheelchair.
He was sitting in a special chair that had holes in the seat.
That's right. But I think it was important to make sure that this was convincing because it really sells the idea of Jake in his freedom as an avatar versus how he was trapped on Earth.
Yep. I have some if you don't.
Back in the makeup trailer for Criminal Law and Student Slayings, special effects artist Jerry Constantine is finishing his victim's look by creating what he delicately calls the meat, uglifying the wound he's made in the actor's throat.
I'm going to add a little bit of glue here, and then a little bit of cotton.
Jerry pushes a strip of cotton dabbed with red food coloring in along the slit line, and then, with a tiny spatula, he applies what looks like raspberry jelly on top of the cotton, and, ick, thickened blood.
This is the fun part.
Why is this fun?
Well, because this is where it starts to come together, and
I can't look at this anymore. I hate to tell you, Jerry.
Because it looks so real. The special makeup effects are done. It's time to shoot, or slash.
And action rehearsal.
Mom, Tommy.
Cut. Can't let you hear anymore. We took a secrecy oath. We promised not to give away any clues that could spoil your terror.
68/69.
In California, where killers and their victims can have dinner together after a long day's work, and extraterrestrials go home and do laundry. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
I'm just imagining Susan with her right hand raised, taking that secrecy oath. Now, after you finished your breakfast, you can find a photo gallery of that gory neck gash and some specialty props from Avatar, Iron Man, and Terminator at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Now let's take a case history of sorts, comparing a country that ran up big debts and a country that did not. Each country is a Caribbean island, Jamaica and Barbados. Alex Bloomberg of our Planet Money team visited both. He found the consequences in a change of GDP per capita, gross domestic product. That's the total amount of goods and services produced in a country divided by the country's population. That affected other measures like reading, writing, and arithmetic.
I went to two elementary schools, one in Jamaica and one in Barbados, both in working-class urban neighborhoods. Jamaica and Barbados are both former British colonies, both parliamentary democracies, but the Jamaican government made a bunch of decisions after independence that weighed it down with debt. As a consequence, its economy barely grew, and now its GDP per capita is a third of what it is in Barbados. And that difference has huge implications in a place like this.
Incomes and painful joys can be caused by a lack of
vitamin D. I'm in a classroom in Almondtown Elementary School in Kingston, Jamaica, standing next to a bunch of boys who high-five every time they get a right answer on a multiple-choice health quiz. The principal, Candy Lee Crook-Smith, is giving me a tour and my first hint of how GDP affects the lives of kids. A low GDP means governments don't have as much tax revenue, which means they can't spend very much on their schools. In Almondtown, Crook-Smith has to find creative ways to pay for bare essentials, extra toilet paper, cleaning supplies, even the whiteboard at the front of this classroom.
The whiteboard was actually provided by the teacher himself because the school can't afford to change the chalkboards.
GDP affects the lives of kids here in another way as well. In Jamaica, every sixth grader takes a test, and the test determines where you go to high school. If you do well on the test, you go to a decent school, which prepares you for college and a professional job. But if you don't score near the top on this test, you go to something called a non-traditional high school, where there are far fewer resources.
The odds are more against them.
And what does that mean when the odds are against? What does that mean? They graduate and...
For most of them, in the non-traditional high schools, we have a lot of behavioral problems. And I think most of the students just basically give up.
If you graduate from one of these schools, your options are limited to low-paying, non-skilled work. You might drop out of the labor force entirely and find work in the informal economy, drugs, gangs, or simply selling stuff on the side of the road. I talked to the Jamaican Minister of Education, who told me the problem is that there simply aren't enough high schools in Jamaica. He figures he needs another 150 to meet the demand, which would take about $1 billion U.S. to build. $1 billion that Jamaica, with its low GDP per capita, does not have. I asked Candy Lee Crook-Smith, the principal, if the government did have the money to give her, what would she do with it?
I have hired a reading teacher, not paid by the ministry either. But I'm thinking if I could get just one extra person in every classroom to focus on the reading alone, I think we would achieve way more than what we're doing right now.
Now, let's head to Barbados, specifically the Lawrence T. Gay Primary School in the largest city in Barbados, Bridgetown. The principal here, Beverly Paris, walks me around from classroom to classroom. Her school, like the school in Jamaica, has lots of bright colors, lots of shapes cut from construction paper on the walls. But the Barbados government, because of the higher GDP, has access to a lot more money, which means more resources in classrooms like the one Beverly Paris is showing me.
Television on the wall and so on. So
Television, there's like a little... It looks like a server closet.
Yes. Multimedia projectors, video cameras, the whole works.
And that's funded by the Ministry of
Education? By the Ministry of Education, yes.
So in terms of what you wish you had versus what you actually have, it's not that big a difference, right?
Not really. As I said, in our class, we shouldn't complain.
In Barbados, almost every sixth grader can read. In Jamaica, a quarter can't. The kids are just as bright. The teachers as hardworking. The only difference is one little statistic. For NPR News, I'm Alex Bloomberg.
Here's a consequence of dragging out the healthcare debate until an election year. Democrats face united Republican opposition. They're desperately trying to stay united themselves in the face of much lobbying pressure, and that pressure is only growing more intense because many Democrats are looking toward their reelection campaigns in November. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Congressman Mike Arcuri is a Democrat representing a historically Republican district in upstate New York. Arcuri supported the House version of the health care overhaul back in November. Opponents hope to change his mind by reaching out to voters in his district.
Our Congressman Mike Arcuri voted for Obama and Pelosi's health care takeover.
Arcuri is one of 11 lawmakers targeted in these TV ads by a group calling itself the League of American Voters.
America said slow down, but now Pelosi and Obama are at it again, and they want Arcuri as the deciding vote in a last-minute deal to take over your health care.
The League is spending $250,000 a week on these ads, and brace yourself for a wave of dinnertime telemarketing calls brought to you by House Republicans' campaign committee. In an effort to reassure nervous House members and shore up support for his health care plan, President Obama hosted more than a dozen members of Congress for back-to-back meetings at the White House yesterday. Spokesman Robert Gibbs says next week the president will take his campaign on the road with health care events in Philadelphia and St. Louis.
The president will describe the benefits of the legislation, why this is important for our country and why it's important for them. And again, reiterating what happens if we walk away from reform. What happens if everyone just takes their toys and goes home?
Mr. Obama's also hoping to mobilize the network of grassroots supporters that helped to elect him, this time in the service of his legislative agenda. Spokeswoman Linda Tran says Organizing for America volunteers have promised to spend millions of hours this year working for lawmakers who support the health care proposal.
You can bet that you're going to be seeing OFA people on the phones, on the doors, and on the streets in the coming weeks.
But President Obama and his supporters have already been making their case for almost a year now. And while polls show voters support many of the provisions included in the health care bill, they're still uncomfortable with the overall package. Political analyst Charlie Cook of the Cook Political Report is skeptical Democrats can suddenly start winning the messaging war they've been losing so far.
Republicans have done a very effective job raising anxieties, raising questions about this, increasing doubt to the point that people just sort of pull back.
But Democrats may have gotten a helping hand in recent weeks from an unlikely source, insurance companies. News that a California insurer tried to raise premiums by up to 39% has become a rallying cry at the White House and a reminder that even those who have insurance are at risk in the current system. Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius drove that message home yesterday during a White House meeting with insurance executives.
People across America are really frightened that they're being priced out of the market. They're terrified that they're next.
White House spokesman Gibbs says that anxiety has helped to crystallize people's concerns about the existing health care system. At a time when many Americans are focused on their pocketbooks, runaway insurance bills underscore the idea that health care is an economic issue. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
President Obama had his physical this week. The results showed he needs to watch his cholesterol and that he's still struggling to quit smoking. Doctor and commentator Joe Wright was troubled by something else, one of the tests the president was given.
President Obama went for a medical checkup this week, and though it was care for Obama, I worried that there might not be quite enough Obamacare. I hope that President Obama can keep some secrets between him and his doctor. And not knowing the president as a patient, I know that tests that I might not recommend in general may be a good idea for specific situations. But to an outsider, without knowing his secrets, some of the president's checkup sounded like the medical marketing phenomenon known as the executive checkup. More tests make the wealthy patient feel special, but the extra tests don't give any true health benefit. In health policy, the president has diagnosed that kind of health care as a waste of time and money. In his own care, though, the president got a CT scan, which his doctors will use to calculate a coronary artery calcium score. That's supposed to help define his future risk for heart disease. The scan gave President Obama an extra dose of radiation and a small extra chance of cancer in the future. The trade-off is that his doctors get some more information about his cardiac risk beyond what they know from cholesterol and blood pressure. And the president's doctors, like many doctors around the country, can order any test they think will be even a little bit useful. But if the CT scan had showed narrowing in the blood vessels of the president's heart, that could have led his doctors to do more invasive testing. Those tests could have risks like kidney damage and serious bleeding. And would the risks pay off? We know the president can play a hard game of basketball without apparent symptoms of heart problems. We know for sure that smoking will be bad for the president's heart in the future. Coronary calcium scores might make predictions for his future even more accurate. but no one has proven the extra accuracy helps survival or quality of life. And it doesn't take a CT scan to know that President Obama should keep exercising, watch his diet, and quit smoking. So deciding not to do a test like this CT scan isn't just about avoiding the financial cost of the test. If the results of the test won't change what we recommend, then the patient is taking risks for data that won't make a difference. If we always choose tests that might be a little bit useful instead of holding out only for tests that are clearly useful, we end up with too many tests and too much risk associated with testing itself. For any given patient, getting more data is almost irresistible to both doctors and patients. But more data is not better health. In fact, if we end up spending lots of time chasing down abnormal test results, more data can actually mean worse health. I'm not the presidential doctor, so why he got the tests he did, I can't say with certainty. But I know for sure that a lot of people get tests like coronary artery calcium CT scans because they want special health care, more health care. In the process, they miss out on what President Obama and most of the rest of us say we want for the future, better health care.
Joe Wright is a resident physician at a Harvard teaching hospital in Boston. You can comment on his essay at the opinion section of npr.org.